as long as families need it.
Megan Curran, I want to thank you for being with us at the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University. We'll link to your report on increasing poverty in the U.S. during the pandemic. And a reminder, this Tuesday, November 3rd, election night, Democracy Now! Will air a three-hour election night special from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. We'll be covering results from the presidential election to congressional and state races, as well as ballot initiatives. You can watch it at democracynow.org, or you can ask your station to run it, as many are across the country. That does it for our broadcast. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman-Whittler and Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Donate to KBOO. Support KBOO. Give to KBOO now. Help KBOO reach our fall fundraising goal of $80,000. Got some extra funds you can donate right now? Then go to KBOO.fm today and click on the donate button. Join the thousands of KBOO members who believe in volunteer-powered, listener-supported community radio today.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, a plea for unity in Portland as the election draws near. And in Washington State, a major union also sounds a warning that election results may not be in as quickly this time around. Plus, a local author writes a book about Oregon's climate kids in the Juliana versus United States case. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 29th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I am Annette Newell. A group of faith leaders in the Portland area is calling for peace and civility as the election draws closer. United in Spirit Oregon includes Jewish, Christian, African American, and Native communities. Leaders plan to meet tomorrow morning in Pioneer Square, calling for peace and civility in Portland and saying they're concerned about the divisiveness and potential for violence around the upcoming elections. The groups involved include the Archdiocese of Portland, Congregation Kesser Israel, the Native American Youth and Family Center, Trinity Episcopal Cathedral, and many more. The Jewish Federation of Greater Portland's Bob Horenstein says, quote, in the case of a close or contested election, as might happen on November 3rd, we ask for patience and trust in the electoral process as we allow for every vote to be counted. We ask all Oregonians to set a standard of civil discourse and opposition to violence. It's less than a week until Election Day, and already a major union in Washington State is joining the chorus of voices saying it could take longer than usual for the final results to come in. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
A Washington State union is preparing for possible outcomes and a lack of results on election night. President of the American Federation of Teachers of Washington, Karen Strickland, says the nation most likely won't know who has won the presidential contest on Tuesday, opening up space for the spread of misinformation. Strickland says Washingtonians already understand the results from mail-in voting can take days to come back, and the lead can shift back and forth between candidates.
That becomes important because in states where they're not accustomed to mail-in voting, they might think that that's a sign of some shenanigans or, you know, that something is amiss when we know that that's normal.
More than 2.2 million, or about 46%, of Washington state voters have returned their ballots, according to the Secretary of State's office. In lieu of an in-person get-together, Strickland says AFT Washington is holding a virtual gathering on election night. She says it's important for people to connect on Tuesday to relieve some of the anxiety that has built up pre-election.
If all of this was happening, but we were able to be together in person, it would feel so much more manageable. I just think it's really exacerbated by working in isolation from one another.
Strickland says the union is preparing members for possible protests. She adds there's a movement among labor councils across the state and nation to take peaceful action.
We need to have a coherent, coordinated response, and it's all about ensuring that we have a democratic election, that it really is free and fair and that we can trust that the results are the correct results by the end of it.
She also wants members to keep the big picture in mind, noting that Washington state lawmakers will be convening their first session since the pandemic hit in January. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The U.S. Supreme Court blocks North Carolina and Pennsylvania Republicans from throwing out mailed ballots that arrive after Election Day. And a Texas court is requiring people to wear masks at polling places. With more on these stories, here's Lily Bulkey.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
This is the election in which I have been most concerned about voter intimidation and the prospect of violence.
Sherilyn Efill with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund is concerned about threats of violence before, during, and after Election Day.
We saw circumstances last week in which even law enforcement officers appeared to be engaged in voter intimidation. And it also was a circumstance in which we have to fear that in some places, local law enforcement cannot be counted on.
Late yesterday, the Supreme Court blocked Republican lawsuits in Pennsylvania and North Carolina. In both cases, ballots must be postmarked by Election Day. But North Carolina can count ballots received up to 9 days afterwards, and Pennsylvania has until November 6th. New Justice Amy Coney Barrett did not vote, saying she hadn't had enough time to consider either case. According to the latest state polling averages, Pennsylvania is one of eight swing states where it's impossible to predict whether Trump or Biden will win, along with Arizona, Iowa, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, and Texas. All eight went for Trump in 2016. Here's Annette Tadeo, a state senator from Miami.
No matter what the polls say, we are always decided by 1% or less. For anybody to suggest that it wasn't going to be close, they clearly do not understand Florida.
Pollsters predict that Trump needs to win most of those states or some combination of swing and Democrat-leaning states to be reelected. In 2016, state polls incorrectly predicted an electoral win for Hillary Clinton right up to Election Day. But prominent pollsters say they've adjusted their methods to be more accurate this time. The only state where polls changed significantly in the past week is Texas, which just turned from, quote, leaning Republican to, quote, toss-up. With 38 delegates, Texas is a potentially game-changing prize. Luke Warford with the Texas Democratic Party says they've been registering infrequent voters.
Texas isn't a red state. It's a non-voting state. And I think that that's totally reflected in the shifting demographics of the state.
Gains in voter registrations can still be outweighed by tactics to suppress the vote, like requiring an excuse to vote by mail, voter IDs at the polls, and Republican Governor Greg Abbott's decree that each county can only have one secure ballot drop-off site, even if they have to travel hundreds of miles, especially given it's too late to mail ballots. Here's Anthony Gutierrez, executive director of Common Cause Texas.
The governor and secretary of state did nothing to expand vote by mail. Despite multiple lawsuits, Texas is one of the only places where you just were not able to do that. So a lot of people who wanted to vote by mail are having to go to poll sites right now and on Election Day.
Texas voters may feel safer going to the polls now. Yesterday, a federal court in San Antonio ruled that all in-person voters, poll workers, and poll watchers must wear masks. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
If Democrats take back the majority in the U.S. Senate, as many polls predict, the Pacific Northwest senators would get some powerful leadership positions. According to Politico, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden would take the reins of the Finance Committee. Wyden says he would want to focus on pandemic relief, which has stalled. California Democrat Dianne Feinstein could become the chairwoman of the Judiciary Committee. And both of Washington senators would be in line for top posts. Senator Maria Cantwell could take over the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, and a Democratic Senate majority would hand control of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee to Washington Senator Patty Murray. This week, U.S. Senate Republicans on a strictly party-line vote approved Amy Coney Barrett as the newest U.S. Supreme Court justice. All Senate Democrats and two Republicans opposed the nomination. Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden explained why he voted no.
Republican nominees for the courts always come before the Senate and talk about how it's the text of the laws as written, respecting precedent, respecting the original meaning of the Constitution. What happens when they join the bench? They throw out longstanding precedents, restrict individual rights, push forward with an agenda that favors special interests and the powerful. For example, Judge Barrett gutted a consumer protection law from the bench by essentially ignoring the text of the law itself, making it easier for debt collectors to prey on the vulnerable. Judge Barrett threw out precedent to deny $332 in damages to a woman who was injured in a medical procedure. The woman was actually unable to afford a lawyer, and she mistakenly used the wrong word to describe the money she was owed. Judge Barrett used that mistake against her. She ignored another existing precedent to take away a jury award from a teenager who was repeatedly raped by a prison guard. She sided with a company that segregated employees by race. In another case, she came up with a twisted interpretation of the Age Discrimination and Employment Act to allow discrimination against older job applicants. None of that had anything to do with calling balls and strikes or respecting the laws as written. Those rulings favor the powerful and corporations over people who don't have clout and don't have vast sums of money to protect themselves. President and Senate Republicans have packed the courts from the top on down with far-right judges who excuse these kinds of ideological rulings. They blocked Democratic judicial nominees for years. They had a plan to remove seats from the D.C. court rather than considering the sitting Democratic president's nominees. Now, the president pushed through an immense number of nominees, given how many seats Republicans left open through obstruction. Some of these judges have been deemed not competent for the job by nonpartisan legal groups. It's done incredible damage to the legitimacy and the independence of the judiciary. And virtually all of them tell the same story about originalism and sticking to the text in the tradition of Justice Scalia. Justice Scalia is considered to be the ultimate example of what is considered originalism. Judge Barrett recently said his judicial philosophy is mine, too. Judge Scalia, in fact, packed his opinions with ideology. He wrote that the decision granting same-sex couples the right to marry was, quote, a threat to American democracy that robs the people of the freedom to govern themselves. He wanted to throw out the Affordable Care Act. He helped gut the Voting Rights Act in a ruling that's led to massive voter disenfranchisement. What's behind all this talk about originalism and sticking to the text of the laws as written is a political agenda, plain and simple. Taking away people's health care, disenfranchising voters, entrenching minority rule, giving corporations more power over their employees, legalizing discrimination against the LGBTQ community and against Black, Hispanic, Asian, and other groups of Americans. It's about cementing government control over women's bodies. Republicans could never enact these deeply unpopular policies through legislation, so they want the Supreme Court to enact their agenda for them. And I want to close by way of saying all of this is contrary to what Justice Ginsburg spent her career fighting for. It's exactly what the big rush to fill the Ginsburg seat is all about, and how this process torpedoes any opportunity for the Senate to come together on other big issues. My Democratic colleagues and I have been pleading with the majority, essentially going and saying, look, let's work together on a major COVID package, virtually pleading that we work in a bipartisan way to help people on what I have heard again and again at home is their number one concern. Mitch McConnell said, however, that it was, quote, too complicated to get done. Last week, I brought forward a bill on enhanced unemployment insurance, a lifeline for jobless workers. It was blocked. 2 days ago, Democrats brought forth a series of bills, including proposals addressing domestic violence, election security, and child care. All blocked. This nomination to Senate Republicans comes first, and absolutely everything else is on hold, gotta wait, and we see really no genuine interest to do the hard work of putting it together. So this nomination and this process are not on the level. Republicans are again breaking their word to hand the Supreme Court to the far right, and I know that because I've heard from so many Oregonians about it. Oregonians were worried about losing their health care, their vote, and so many of their fundamental freedoms. They're worried about what this means for the future of the country. This debate is about the Ginsburg seat. Justice Ginsburg was not just an iconic fighter for the rights of the powerless and the vulnerable. She always said what she meant, and she meant what she said. We did not get that from Judge Barrett.
That was Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden explaining why he voted against the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Portland City Council is considering an $18 million cut to the Portland Police Bureau's budget. This follows intense public testimony during last night's meeting. Commissioners Joanne Hardesty and Chloe Udaly are spurring on the budget cut. They hope to redirect the money toward housing and COVID-19 relief. With $7.5 million to the Oregon Housing Authority to help those facing evictions during the pandemic, and $7.4 million aimed at emergency food assistance, Hardesty says the redirection of money should immediately help underrepresented populations ravaged by COVID-19. But Portland Police Chief Chuck Lavelle says he believes the cuts will be detrimental to the community. Lavelle notes an $18 million cut would require layoffs, reduce training and diversity initiatives, and could affect the Bureau's ability to respond to 911 calls. After 5 hours of public testimony Wednesday, Mayor Ted Wheeler and Commissioners Amanda Fritz and Dan Ryan said they need time to consider the proposal. Wheeler said, quote, "It's our job to ensure any decisions we make result in the changes we want to see." The budget adjustment would also cut money for the Social Emergency Response Team and the Rapid Response Team, both parts of the police response to protest activity, which has continued almost nightly for months. Sarah Iannarone, Wheeler's opponent in next week's election for mayor, supports the cut, saying, quote, "In June, we had $4 million in police overtime. We are going to be over budget in terms of police staffing this year through bad management." The council expects to review and consider the amendments on Thursday, November 5th. Oregon has once again broken its daily case record for COVID-19 infections. Today, the Oregon Health Authority reported 575 new cases, the highest number in a single day since the pandemic started. They also reported two more deaths, and there are 75 active workplace outbreaks in Oregon this week. More Oregonians tested positive for COVID-19 last week than any other week since the infection started. COVID-19 has killed 673 people in Oregon so far, 2,353 in Washington, more than 228,000 in the U.S., and more than 1,170,000 people around the world. The Kroger Company, which owns Fred Meyer, will start offering rapid antibody COVID-19 testing to customers, following approval from the Food and Drug Administration. The test involves a finger prick blood sample to determine whether a person has previously been infected with the coronavirus. With more than 2,200 pharmacy locations in 35 states, Kroger Health, the company's healthcare segment, says the rapid testing will be available by the end of November, building on its clinic and at-home testing services. The tests cost $25 and provide results in about 15 minutes, informing people if they've been previously infected by detecting antibodies to the virus causing COVID-19. Whitmire Medical is supplying the test to Kroger. It's telling those with coronavirus symptoms not to be tested using this new service until after symptoms have passed, allowing antibodies to be detected accurately. Kroger Health President Colleen Lindholt says the testing will improve concerns for families and individuals seeking a quick and affordable test solution to detect previous infections. She says rapid antibody testing helps clinicians understand the long-term impacts of COVID-19 and strategies for fighting the disease. The supermarket giant Kroger owns a large family of stores, including QFC, Fred Meyer, Payless, Ralph's, City Market, and Dillon's. You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, mainly clear skies down to an overnight low of 43. And tomorrow, we're likely to see some rain showers early in the day and then sunshine later, a high of 59 degrees. Today in history, on this date in 1998, astronaut John Glenn became the oldest human ever to travel in space when he launched from Earth aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery. This came almost four decades after he became the first American to orbit the Earth in 1962. The quote of the day is from John Glenn, who said, "The most important thing we can do is inspire young minds and to advance the kind of science, math, and technology education that will help youngsters take us to the next phase of space travel." A Portland woman spent more than a year with the children in Oregon and across the country at the heart of the Giuliani cases. Their challenge of federal and state governments' responsibility on climate change has already made history and is about to once again. I talked to the local author about her latest creation.
My name is Lee Vandervoo. My book is As the World Burns. It's the new generation of activists in the landmark legal fight against climate change. It follows the 21 youth plaintiffs in the Giuliani versus the United States climate lawsuit against the government for a year from their canceled trial and into the broader youth climate movement. There are 11 plaintiffs from Oregon. About half the plaintiffs are from Oregon. I do write about several of the Oregon plaintiffs.
Tell me how the Oregon plaintiffs were involved. Obviously, Giuliani, the case is named after Giuliani.
Yeah, Kelsey Giuliani is the namesake plaintiff. She is an Oregonian. There are two Oregon plaintiffs from Southern Oregon who are litigating impacts to their family farms. There are plaintiffs from Oregon who are litigating impact to drought conditions, to oceans, to worsening allergies and asthma as a result of climate change. The two Oregonians from Southern Oregon who are litigating impacts to their family farms are in part litigating increased risk from wildfire.
That was part of the case even before this fire season, which was pretty horrendous.
Yes, the case was filed in 2015, and it's been in the courts since that time. And yeah, increased wildfire risk has been an issue for two of the plaintiffs since before then.
We are expecting actually any day now a decision from the Ninth Circuit. What are the options of what could happen there?
The Ninth Circuit dismissed the Giuliani case from the court earlier this year, basically saying that it's a separation of powers issues for the courts to rule on climate change, that in order to instruct the executive branch to have a climate plan, which is what the plaintiffs are requesting, the court would have to supervise the executive branch for years. And that in American politics and law is a no-no. So what the plaintiffs have asked is that decision was made by a 3-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit. And what the plaintiffs have asked is that the full Ninth Circuit rehear their case. So any day now, there'll be a decision on that. And what will happen will either be that the full Ninth Circuit will rehear the case, so a selection of 10 judges from the Ninth Circuit Court, and decide whether or not it can go to trial in the lower district court, or they will reject the case again. In either case, it's probably extremely likely that the next appeal will be to the Supreme Court.
So you're thinking that they could make a decision to not even rehear it, right?
Yes.
In which case they could appeal that?
Yeah. If the Ninth Circuit were to make a decision to not rehear the case, then the plaintiffs have the option to appeal to the Supreme Court. And in the event that the Ninth Circuit decides to rehear the case, whether they have that hearing in the next year or so or don't, in all likelihood, the government has at every turn appealed this case to a degree that is really quite unusual, honestly. I mean, there were moments where this case was being litigated in the district court and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court all at the same time. So the likelihood that the U.S. government is going to let this go to rehearing or back to trial is very low, especially with a stacked Supreme Court and a Trump administration. Very likely this will turn into a Supreme Court appeal.
Why did you decide to write this book? Why was it an important issue for you?
You know, it's an important issue, I think, for everyone. I mean, climate change is real. It's urgent. It is happening now. The United States has no plan, comprehensive plan, to address it. And right now we're living in times where the solutions are within reach. Perpetuating a climate breakdown past a point where the technologies are going to be available to deal with the consequences is a concerning thing. And, you know, we heard from the UN's International Panel on Climate Change in 2018 that we had 12 years really to react to this problem. Now we've eaten the clock for another couple of years. You know, that same year was the year that the Giuliani case was canceled. You know, the government is telling these kids, well, you know, if you don't like what the executive branch is doing about climate change, just go ahead and vote them out. That's pretty hard when most of the litigants aren't old enough to vote and aren't voting constituents to their congressional legislators who might also be able to make a change. So, you know, we're kind of reaching this point where the executive branch has punted, Congress has punted, and now the courts are punting on a solution, and we're out of time.
Do you live in Oregon?
I do live in Oregon, yeah.
And are you a longtime resident here?
I've been here for 20 years.
In that time, what have you seen happening in terms of climate change?
Well, I think, it's fairly obvious that wildfires are worsening, and if you look at the science, you know, the wildfire season has extended by 78 days since I believe the mid-60s. So I don't think it's any secret to anybody that wildfires are worsening. That's probably the biggest issue that we have. But we're also seeing more subtle things, worsening drought, increasing ocean acidification, rising temperatures. All of those things will impact Oregon over time.
How's your book tour going?
It's going fine. You know, I'm not doing it physically like we planned. I'm doing it virtually. But I have a lot of events and some media, and so that's good.
And you've written books before, right?
Yeah, that's my second book.
Congratulations. That's great. Is your educational background in science or anything like that?
I'm a journalist.
Thought maybe that you were drawn to...
That I had a lot of science.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I started out in college in the sciences, but I ended up with a journalism degree, so I have some background. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not a stranger to it, but most of my reporting has been environmental reporting over the years.
And the title of the book, As the World Burns, why did you choose that title?
I actually didn't choose the title, but it is a line in the book that eventually became the title, and it was a joke. After the Giuliana trial was canceled in October 2018, I was reporting the case for Reuters, and I called my editor and I said, I think our courtroom drama is, or courtroom thriller is turning into a courtroom drama. And he said, As the World Burns, and then he chuckled, and it was kind of a play on the soap opera, As the World Turns. Well, a couple days later, it wasn't funny anymore, because that was when the campfire broke out in California, the fire that decimated paradise. But, you know, at the time, it was just making light of the situation. And now here we are years later.
Yeah.
With a lot of burning.
Do you feel optimistic about these kids' chances of getting a good settlement of some sort that's going to help the issue?
I think whether the case ends up at trial or ends up in some kind of remediation plan or is settled by the government or not, however it ends, I think the case is really, really important. I think it's raised the profile of climate change for a lot of people. And I think it's made clear, like, the sense of urgency that Gen Z feels about this issue. And those are all good things. I would say no matter how it ends in the courts, the kids are winning the culture war. And that's incredibly important.
Good point. And when was the book published?
It was published September 29th,
okay.
Maybe 3 weeks ago. And I think earlier I said the International Panel on Climate Change. It's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
You know what? I also wanted to get your description of basically the devotion of these kids to this issue, these kids from Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like? What were your impressions of them?
My impressions of them are that they're really committed to the cause and very well educated on it, which is an interesting thing, I think, because our traditional paradigm is that older people are wiser, right? And I think when this case was filed and in its early years, a lot of folks dismissed it thinking, you know, how can kids make the case for the planet? What do they really know? Just looking at their age and kind of dismissing them. And honestly, my experience in reporting on climate change is that young people are so much better educated about climate change than older adults. And these folks are ambassadors for the cause. They're steeped in it. They've been advocates since very early days. They came to the cause from their corners of the advocacy world, and they take it very seriously.
Can you give me an anecdote about one specific kid from Oregon that impressed you?
Kelsey Giuliana is very impressive, and she walked across the country at an incredibly young age to raise awareness about climate change. I think that she spent more than half her life at this point talking to kids in classrooms, doing community outreach, being a plaintiff in this lawsuit, being a plaintiff in a state-level lawsuit in Oregon as well. She has committed so much of her time and energy to not only raising the profile of this issue, but finding solutions. And, I mean, that is really commendable, especially for somebody who at this point is only 24 years old.
That is pretty amazing. Anything else I haven't asked you that you would like people to know about?
For me, one of the reasons that I wrote the book was spending time with young people and talking to them about this issue was really transformed my perspective about it. I understand climate change as an older adult as a remote issue, something that we could solve by making individual choices at the cash register. And I'm almost embarrassed to say that because it's so not true. I mean, we need broader systemic change, and we need to work together on solutions as a nation. But hearing the urgency from young people about what it means to them for us to continually abdicate our responsibility to the next generations in addressing this problem was such an eye-opening experience that I felt compelled to write it.
listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Annette Newell, Althea Billings, Eric Tegedoff, and Lily Bolke. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us for the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On Tuesday, October 13th, KBOO hosted a virtual debate between the two candidates vying for Portland City Commission Position 4. They are the incumbent, Chloe Udaly, and her opponent, Mingus Mapps. The debate was moderated by KBOO's own Annette Newell. If you hear a bell, that was to let candidates know their time was up.
We're going to start with a very important topic to both of you. Police reform. Chloe, you know, you're supporting reductions to the police budget right now. Why is that? And what should that money be spent on?
Sure. Well, you know, we began the process of divesting in our police bureau, which gets the majority of our general funds every year, and investing in community in June. This is going to be an ongoing conversation, and it's is being led and should be led by Black community leaders and advocates. So since that budget vote, I've been working with the group that's now become Reimagine Oregon, which is a Black-led initiative detailing the various ways that state, regional, and local governments can advance progressive policy change and need to invest in community. I think it's clear that our models of public safety and policing are outdated, and they're not working. And people are suffering, and BIPOC communities, people experiencing mental illness and disabilities, and people experiencing homelessness are really suffering the consequence of disparate impacts of the way that we police. I support further reductions, but I support that only if we are able to stand up new structures and systems to do the work that we're taking away from police. For instance, Portland Street Response is a great example of, you know, something we should have never left up to police, which is intervening with people who are experiencing mental health crises on the street. I'm looking at what it would take to take traffic enforcement out of the police bureau and put it under PBOT. Just another example of ways in which we can take a less punitive approach and a more community-based approach to create a safer and more just city for everyone.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Udaly. Now, Mingus, you're saying you want to reform not just the police, but city government in general in your platform. Yeah. What's that going to look like?
Oh my God, that will look like a reimagining of City Hall. Portland has a unique form of government, what we call a commission form of government. It means that each member of council not only votes on policy issues or budgets, they are also the day-to-day chief operating officer for at least one city bureau. This is one of the reasons why Portland actually is so dysfunctional. There's no other city in America that uses this approach. Most other cities abandoned this approach to government about 100 years ago. What we would do is what every other city our size does. We would hire a city manager who's charged with coordinating services across city bureaus. That way, we could spend our dollars more effectively and focus our resources more effectively. The other set of changes I want to make to how City Hall works include increasing the number of seats on City Council. Right now, we have four members of City Council. I think we need more, and I want to change the way we fill those seats. Right now, every member of City Council runs at large, which means I run everywhere from, you know, the border of Gresham out to the West Hills. I think that we should move to a new system of neighborhood-based electoral districts. That way, voices from every corner of the city are represented down in City Hall chambers.
Mm-hmm. Both of you are listing racial justice as a priority in this election. Mingus, you say you want to build a public safety system that's free of racism. What would you do to achieve that goal?
Oh, sure. Well, the first thing that we need to do is state that as a policy, which has to pervade everything that we do in the public safety realm. So we need to have a zero tolerance policy for racing and policing. We need to abandon policies that focus on practices that we know are bad, things like chokeholds. I also want to basically get the police out of the business of policing poverty. Right now, about half of our 911 calls basically come down to policing someone who's houseless or poor, who's having a crisis on the streets. If we could do that, we would dramatically decrease the amount of tension that we have between civilians and our armed police officers. And finally, I think, and most importantly, I think one of the things that we need to do is set up an independent system of police review. That way, when things do go wrong in the public safety realm, Portlanders can have a mechanism that we have faith in for holding our police officers accountable.
Okay, let's turn to Chloe now. What have you done to make racial justice a priority in Portland? And what would you do if you're reelected?
Sure. Thanks for the question, Annette. At first, I'd just like to quickly say I'm glad to hear that my opponent and I are so aligned on policing issues. In fact, his entire platform is made up of things that City Council has already done or are in the process of doing. But he's also endorsed by the police union, which is our biggest impediment to transforming our police system in Portland and around the country. So I'm deeply skeptical of his ability to deliver on true reform. As far as my work around racial justice, you know, whether it's in civic life or PBOT or the housing policies we've developed, we always center the people who are the least well-served and the most negatively impacted by whatever system it is we're trying to improve or correct. And that is often, almost always, BIPOC community members. So for instance, every time we do a major project at PBOT, we ask the question, how will this advance our racial equity goals? When we were developing fair access and renting policy, we were trying to solve for housing discrimination in the ways that income and credit score and prior convictions can become proxies for race. And even with the Rose Lane Project, which is a project to get public transit unstuck from congestion to make transit a more reliable and viable transportation option for people across the city, the way we planned that project was based on how many jobs a single working Black mom in East Portland, how many additional jobs would she be able to access on faster transportation? Because commute time is the biggest determinant of whether a household can lift themselves up out of poverty.
Mm-hmm. If I can actually use one of my rebuttals here.
Sure, go ahead.
Sure, and I'll just make this quick. I know I only have a couple of seconds. I want to say that I was endorsed by the police bureau, probably for many of the same reasons that Commissioner Udaly's bureau hired me to help lead the Office of Civic Life. I have a long history of helping bring community policing to East Portland, and I am proud of the work that I did to bring crime prevention to every corner of the city when I worked for the Office of Civic Life. I do think there is a difference in our approaches. I think that the Office of Civic Life has been very much gutted under Commissioner Udaly's leadership. Doesn't mean that there's not room for improvement and evolution there. But when I'm in office, I think one of the things I'll try to do is to make crime prevention and public safety a mechanism that actually helps people solve their public safety problems right now. I can't tell you how many times a day I talk to Portlanders who tell me, you know, Mengus, someone literally shot the front door of my building last night. Or, you know, I talked to business owners who tell me that they were armed with guns and the cops don't come to respond to problems like that anymore. I think that's outrageous. And when I'm on city council, I will make sure that we have responses and programs to address everyday public safety problems like that.
Okay. We have a question right now from KBOO listener Ray Chapman Wilson. He's asking, what can be done regarding white supremacists seemingly gaining protection and support from Portland police during violent clashes? Mingus?
Sure. Well, we're on radio, so folks may not know that I'm an African-American man. I'm the only candidate in this race who knows what it's like to live in Portland at a time when, you know, racist groups come through town, you know, seemingly every weekend during the summer. You know, there's a new sad season in Portland for families of color where you keep your kids at home because the Proud Boys are marching through town. When I said earlier, one of the key ways to reform our public safety system is to have a zero tolerance for racism. This is one of the examples I mean and need. We must have zero tolerance for people who come and spread hate and violence in our city. And when I'm on city council, I will enforce this principle. It is important to both me as a person and to our city as a community and my children.
Okay, well, next, we'd like to talk to you about your campaign so far and your track records. Chloe, in your time in office, you tried to reform Portland's system of neighborhood associations, which enjoy a special status in city government. You wanted to expand the kinds of organizations that could be included in that status, and you faced some criticism as a result. Could you talk about that proposal and whether you're still trying to implement that type of reform?
Sure. So what you're talking about is code change. And I invite anyone who wants to learn more about that to visit the website, changethecodepdx.org. It's a very misunderstood effort for many reasons, including the spread of misinformation by opponents, including my opponent in this race. Our neighborhood association network was created decades ago to give neighborhoods a voice in city policymaking because our city was doing things that were harming neighborhoods. And I deeply respect the long history they have of fighting back against City Hall. They, for instance, stopping the Mount Hood Freeway and more recently saving the giant sequoias. They are essentially mutual benefit associations that do really great work in their respective neighborhoods. The problem is civic life's code dictates how every bureau engages with the public. So when we have projects or policies or programs we want feedback on, we only go to the neighborhood associations. And over the last couple of decades, membership has decreased. Membership is not reflective of the full diversity of our community, and therefore, we're not hearing from everyone we need to hear from, which means that we're not always developing the best policy we could or serving the people who are least well served. I'm going to admit I was very naive when I entered this conversation. I really didn't realize how controversial it would be because it seemed so obvious to me that we have to recognize the different ways in which people identify and organize, whether it is by race, ethnicity, culture, being a renter, having a disability, etc. I do not understand the threat that people perceive from this, and it's a conversation that I plan on continuing whether I have the bureau or not. Thank you.
Okay. Mingus, you received an endorsement from the Portland Police Association, which is the union for Portland's police force, which has been mentioned a couple of times by your opponent tonight. How did that endorsement actually come about? And how do you reconcile that endorsement with your plans for police reform?
Oh, sure. How it came about was really straightforward. Commissioner Udaly and I were both invited to speak to the police union's endorsement board. We both went in on the same day. I believe Commissioner Udaly went in the morning and I went in later in the afternoon. At the end of that meeting, they endorsed me and they didn't endorse Commissioner Udaly. I suspect that they endorsed me because I have a long history of working on public safety issues here in Portland. As I've mentioned before, I help keep community policing alive in East Portland, especially in the Park Rose neighborhood. I'm well known for folks who are in the crime prevention community. So if you want to come together as a neighborhood to try to figure out what to do with, you know, illegal dumping at the corner or, you know, the armed robberies that continually happen at the shop on the business strip, you know, our crime prevention coordinators can help you solve that problem. I suspect they also endorsed me because I'm a Black man. And frankly, a lot of the conversations that we're having right now about policing are about how a majority white city goes about policing Black men. And I think that Portland and Oregon has been struggling with that issue for 150 years, and we have not gotten it right in 150 years. And I think that if you want to get it right, it's incredibly important that you have Black men at the table. And I think that's something they saw too.
Yeah, I'd like a rebuttal. Thank you. Sure. Well, I've taken a pledge to never accept money from the police union, and I have never sought their endorsement. You take these endorsements.
Why were you at the endorsement meeting?
I'm entitled to speak without interruption, so thank you. You go to these endorsement meetings because it's seen as very disrespectful not to. And you also go because it's an opportunity, a rare opportunity, to talk to not just union leadership, but rank and file officers. So despite the fact that Daryl Turner was extremely combative with me in that meeting, I did manage to have some good side conversations with some of our officers. I will say that the police union would never endorse someone that was a threat to their agenda or power. Look at our endorsements. My opponent is endorsed not just by the police union, but the landlord lobby and Portland Business Association. Powerful special interests that have held way too much sway over city council for decades and lost their power, the power of three votes on city council when I was elected. And then look at my endorsements. Thank you.
Okay. Mingus, we wanted to ask you also for your thoughts about the code change issue that Chloe raised. What did you think about that?
I think that's a really sad and tragic moment in Portland history. I don't understand why that happened. I don't think it needed to happen. I think, like most Portlanders, neighborhood associations play an important part of our civic culture and our local politics. The commissioners claim that somehow the only folks that the city council is prepared to listen to are members of neighborhood associations. Just strikes me as being bizarre. And it's also just not how democracy works. I think if you're on city council, one of your obligations is to listen to and interact with all of your constituents. And that's certainly the culture and the kind of leadership that I will bring to city council. I will meet with people, even if they disagree with me, and maybe even especially if they disagree with me, very much like the police union endorsement thing. I disagree with the police union on almost everything, but I still think it's incredibly important to talk to them. And I think that Commissioner Udaly may think that too, because she went to the endorsement meeting. So I kind of don't understand the argument that's being made there. So on the neighborhood association thing, I think that they are incredibly important. They are not a perfect system, but as the commissioner in charge of neighborhood associations, it's your first obligation to help neighborhood associations evolve and rise to the moment. Instead, I would argue that Commissioner Udaly very much undermined that important and classic Portland institution. When I'm on city council, should folks choose to send me there, I will reinvent neighborhood associations for the 21st century. I'll help them do outreach. I'll help them become more diverse. I'll make sure that they trade best practices so that every neighborhood association could get better in its own way.
Okay. We have
I'll
another
take a rebuttal.
Question.
Oh, I'd ahead. Like a rebuttal. Thank you. Well, the one thing that Mr. Maps just said that I'm sure is true is I don't understand. So let me explain it to you.
Okay.
Civic life code dictates how all other city bureaus do civic engagement. Neighborhood associations have special recognition in our system. So that means that when bureaus across the city conduct civic engagement, they notify neighborhood coalitions and neighborhood associations, and they're not required to notify anyone else. I don't think it's best practice to leave that decision up to bureaus to decide case by case. I believe expanding those recognized groups to include groups that are identity or issue based is critical. And I did nothing to undermine or change neighborhood associations. In fact, nothing would have changed for them, except they would have to share the table and pass the mic to people that have been left out of our decision-making process for decades.
We have to move on to the next question, I'm afraid. Well, actually, KBOO did a survey of listeners this election season, and the climate crisis was an issue that was consistently brought up. How do you think the city should address climate change, Mingus?
Sure. Well, you know, I think we have to focus on a couple of priorities, things like reducing our use of carbon, reducing our carbon emissions. And we can do that through raising energy efficiency standards on new buildings. I think that we can also more quickly convert our city fleets to green fuels. We need to emphasize renewable energy sources. As we were talking before, public transportation is key here. That's where about 40% of our carbon pollutions come from. And then really focusing in on green infrastructure. So I'm the only candidate in this race who's always been against the expansion of the Rose Quarter Freeway. And I also oppose the traffic down at the Zenith Petroleum terminals. And I think if we follow through with those steps, we can make huge progress. I'll also point out that moving towards a city a manager form of government would be incredibly helpful here. Right now, every bureau in the city takes an ad hoc approach to reducing our carbon emissions and becoming more green. I think that we need an organized, coordinated, citywide approach to that.
Okay, Chloe, you mentioned the climate crisis when you were talking about transportation. What about some other ideas that could help address the climate change problem?
Sure. I mean, I just want to start by clarifying the record. I never supported the Rose Lane corridor, but as the transportation commissioner, I did have to represent the interests of the city and the community in that conversation. And I think it was worth trying to fight for a better project. And when it finally became clear that ODOT was really just going through the motions and they weren't willing to alter the project, I led the city in withdrawing support for that project. Gosh, there's so many things. I mean, like I mentioned, we need to dramatically reduce carbon emissions from our transportation sector. And that will involve everything from converting TriMet's fleet to electric buses, which is a very long-term conversation, building out infrastructure to support people transitioning from internal combustion engines to electric vehicles. I mean, in 2017, I helped write what was then the most ambitious renewables resolution in the country, getting us to 100% renewables by 2050. We now know that timeline is needs to be accelerated because we have probably less than a decade to avert climate catastrophe. We can make all the changes that we want to make at the local level, but the fact remains that climate change doesn't recognize jurisdictional boundaries. So what I'm focused on right now is really working with leaders across the region and at the state and federal level, because we can't solve for climate change all by ourselves, but we can set the standard for cities across the country. And I'm pretty competitive when it comes to pushing progressive policy.
Okay. We have a question that came in from listener Dawn Smallman. She has a question for Mr. Mapps. Will Sure. Mr. Mapps pledge to return the monetary contribution from the police union on the basis that it could compromise how he handles police reform during the contract negotiations should he be voted into office?
Sure. Well, thank you for that important question. And that's one of the challenging things or complicated things about this piece is, you know, the police union endorsed me. I didn't endorse them. And their contribution to me was not a cash contribution. It was an in-kind contribution. Basically, they decided that they sent out a mailer to people on their mailing list saying, you know, we think Mingus is an interesting guy and you should take a look at him. So I can't really give the dollars back. So no. And I would say that there is, I kind of push back on the premise of the question there. I do come to this race with integrity. I'm in this race because I'm a public servant and I'm a Black man. After 50 years of living in this skin, there is no way that an endorsement and an in-kind donation will somehow negate my experience or negate my obligation to, you know, make a world that's better for my children and all of our children.
I'd like a rebuttal.
Sure. Go ahead.
I would never accept an endorsement or a contribution from a person or an organization that I was politically or philosophically opposed to. Your endorsements speak volumes about who you are. And so I absolutely reject my opponent's assertion that that endorsement isn't meaningful. Again, the police union would never endorse someone who's a threat to their agenda or to their power. And he could absolutely give that money back. It's true, it was a $15,000 in kind, I think it was for printing, but he could absolutely give them that money and reject their endorsement if he wanted to. And he clearly doesn't. And I'll just end by saying that, you know, my opponent has talked about his employment in my bureau a lot and made a lot of spurious claims about both his level of responsibility and his achievement in the bureau, which opens the door for me to talk about it. One of the challenges we had with Mr. Mapps was that he actually refused to do the work he was hired to, which was to advance that transition from crime prevention to public safety, or to community safety, and wasn't willing or able to coach the people he was supervising or neighborhood associations about implicit bias, claiming that our crime prevention program, an outdated 1970s National Sheriff Association model, wasn't racist. So I do not buy anything he's saying about that endorsement or his very old school policing approach.
Okay.
Can I rebut there?
Yes. Go ahead. You can have your rebuttal time. Sure.
I'll just say, I think the record is very clear that I was let go from the Office of Civic Life after I refused to retaliate against an employee who was out of favor in the Udaley regime. And I encourage her, I would release Commissioner Udaley to release all the sort of employment records and complaints, both around my case and the hundreds of other cases that are boiling over in the Office of Civic Life, to just let the, you know, the air clear. I think it is truly time for a cleaning of the air that's been happening in Commissioner Udaley's troubled and frankly vaguely corrupt Office of Civic Life.
I would, first of all, I can't release documents on...
But you can talk about them, apparently.
I can't release documents on personnel issues or investigations, but Mr. Mapps has abrogated his right to confidentiality by talking about his employment and his dismissal over and over again. And in fact, your records have been released. So I'm also looking forward to clearing the air, because Mr. Mapps... and many of his supporters have been spreading misinformation about Civic Life, about code change, and about his hiring and firing. He was not recruited. I had nothing to do with his. You applied for a job, Mingus.
I was invited to apply. That's not even the two times your office came to me to ask to work for your regime.
After you, my regime. Okay.
Yeah.
After you were fired from your last job.
I think we need to get back to the issues. Let's get back to the issues, please. We have another question that came in. If November brings a second term for Trump, what steps would you be willing to take to protect our city from federal overreach? And do you think that that's a threat, Chloe?
Yeah, it's absolutely a threat. I mean, I call Election Day 2016 the best and worst night of my life. I would trade my win 1,000 times over to not have Donald Trump be the president of the United States, which are still clearly hard words for me to pronounce or get out of my mouth. My first conversation with then Mayor-elect Wheeler was about his position on our sanctuary city policy. And I was very relieved to hear that he was as strongly supportive as I was. Who knew that instead of building on the progressive change that the Obama administration had delivered in many arenas, that we would just be forced into a defensive position trying to protect some of the most vulnerable members of our community from attack and persecution by our federal administration. I think some of your listeners know about the fence that the feds put up in our public right-of-way, and that I issued a letter and have been assessing a fine on the federal government for their incursion into our space. Some people love that act, and some people thought it was trivial. But this conversation is so much bigger than a fence or a bike lane. It's really about, where do the powers of the federal government end and where do ours begin? And that is absolutely critical. So the city of Portland has been engaged in multiple lawsuits against the federal government over the last 4 years. We will continue to fight for local power and to protect our community members in any way that we have available to us.
Okay. And Mingus, you know, your thoughts. President Trump has obviously made Portland a central campaign issue. Right. He's mentioned our city over and over again. If he is reelected, what steps do you think the city council needs to take?
Well, I think cooperation between the city and the feds, especially on public safety issues, is just off the table. So I want to see no cooperation or interaction with ICE. I don't want to see our cops deputized. I'm so mystified by how that happened. And as long as the Trump administration is in power, I think that we have to, you know, maintain our autonomy. But I think the most important thing here is that Trump not be reelected. So I encourage everyone who's listening to reach out to folks in other states and in our own state to make sure that Joe Biden is able to win the White House.
Let's move on to a topic that I think is top of mind for so many of us in Portland, houselessness. Even before the coronavirus pandemic started, houselessness was one of the most pressing issues in Portland. Now that issue is poised to grow even more due to the pandemic. Okay, Mingus, can you give us your thoughts about houselessness and how to solve it?
Oh, sure. One of the most pressing problems facing Portland. The first thing I want to say, especially at this moment, is that the most efficient way to end homelessness is to prevent people from losing their housing in the first place. That's why I support creating an emergency rental assistance fund until the COVID crisis has ended. I also think and will challenge the city of Portland to join with me in ending chronic homelessness here in Portland. We have about 4,000 people who sleep on the streets every night. I think every night, 365 days a year, if we come together as a community and take some of the resources that have come through some recently passed bonds, I think that we can house or at least offer housing to each and every one of them. And that housing needs to include not only a key to a door, but also a doctor's appointment. The other thing which I think is really important is that we actually get the police out of the business of being our primary outreach workers for houselessness issues. That's why I'm excited about expanding the street response teams and taking that program citywide.
That was an excerpt of the virtual debate between Chloe Udaly and Mingus Maps, who are both candidates for Portland City Commission Position 4. You can find the full video version of the debate on the KBOO Facebook page. You have been listening to KBOO News in Depth. For our moderator, Annette Newell, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO Portland.
You're listening to Rose City Native Radio, Low Res Edition. We've got music and much more coming up for you. It's also a good time to remind you that you can help support community radio today by going to kboo.org.